reassure Ann, it's not a Brokeback Mountain kind of thing. I'm also very pleased to have an apostle comment in my paper. For more than 40 years, I've sent my fair share of letters to people who I'd regard as what you would call general authorities, and maybe I've sent more than my fair share, possibly, but anyway, it's really nice today to be able to stand up here and talk for about 25 or 30 minutes and have an apostle be required to respond, you know, so that's really neat. So I ought to introduce Susan, since you introduced me and we don't have somebody else to do this, these chores. Susan was born in St. Joseph, Missouri, one time my hometown. She went to the University of Missouri when my wife lived there, and met a man in Michigan who lived in Seattle, and was also a friend of mine from Graceland, married him, and they moved to Seattle. She did a variety of things in the church, and really had not been one of those that was kind of lobbying for women in the priesthood, because she was off in Seattle, and it's a little bit away from Independence. But anyway, after 1984, not too long thereafter, she was called to the priesthood. And so anyway, just through several priesthood calls, and I won't go into that, she's going to talk about that Saturday at a panel, she ended up a year ago being appointed, called to be an apostle in the church. We have four women apostles, and only four, so we had to fill out the 12 with eight men. So I graduated from our church college, Graceland, in 1960, with a major in religion. Perhaps it was my professor, Roy Chaville, his discussion of Walter Rauschenbusch and the social gospel, that helped me see that religion should apply to our everyday lives and to the social and political issues in society. As a child in church, it seemed kind of odd. It seemed like about the only thing that were required of us was don't smoke, don't drink. Now, there were some other things in there, but I didn't understand this bit about sex and stuff like that. But so anyway, after graduation at Graceland, I was hired as an editor at our publishing house in Independence, church publishing house. Our managing editor, Roger Yarrington, had written an editorial in 1958 in the Saints Herald on the Little Rock Central High School desegregation crisis, which really still reads well today. He suggested that the civil rights leaders in Arkansas were more like the apostles in the Book of Acts than possibly any other group to be found in the nation today, which probably some saints probably wondered about that. He wrote an editorial on the John Birch Society entitled Merchants of Irresponsible Charges. I think he forgot to clear it with Ezra Taft Benson or his son Reed. He also wrote a book, Restoration Ethics Today, which examined various social issues from a gospel perspective. I was an editor, writer. I wanted the gospel to be relevant to the world around us. Roger was a good role model for me. When I arrived in Independence for this new job in 1960 after graduation, corruption had been rampant at City Hall in Independence. And so when I arrived, the Good Government League had just been organized to fight City Hall. And I was deeply involved in a Good Government League, and we ousted and we succeeded in ousting the machine. We threw the bums out. Early on, I learned the importance of canvassing the voters and making sure that those phone calls to our supporters are made so we maximize our turnout at the polls. We lost one election by 6 votes, although we won another one by about 8 votes, so that really hit home. The issue that really got me politically involved was the civil rights movement, which was at its peak during the 6 years I was at Herald House, 1960 to 66. I had been on a nearly all-black track team at Flint Northern High School and had gotten to know my teammates as human beings, undercutting the stereotypes that I'd learned over and over again before high school. In high school, I saw Martin Luther King on television during the Montgomery bus boycott, and at Graceland, I read King's intellectual autobiography, which I highly recommend to anybody, Pilgrimage to Nonviolence, published at the time in the Christian Century, but republished many places, I'm sure. King became a major influence in my life. When an African-American woman named Virginia Jacobs returned from the March on Washington in August 1963, she called me and suggested that we organize an Independence chapter of CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality, a national civil rights organization founded by James Farmer. Soon we had a CORE organization up and running in Independence. The park across the street from the Truman Library, if you've ever been there, is a nice park across the street. Well, that's where the blacks lived at that time in our core chapter. They lived in the heart of Zion, but their streets were not paved with gold. In fact, they weren't paved at all. They lived in the heart of Zion on dirt roads. Somehow the city's road crews couldn't find their neighborhood right there in the middle of Zion. We met in the homes of Mrs. Jacobs, Mrs. Robinson, and others, and they said this proposed urban renewal project, which led to the park, is really Negro removal. I didn't believe it. I mean, my gosh, after all, the good government league was running the city now. The good guys were there, but they were right, because it was next to impossible for blacks in Independence to buy a home in any neighborhood outside the like two small black neighborhoods. Most of them had to end up living in Kansas City. It was a shock also to learn that one of the two theaters in town and all three bowling alleys did not admit blacks. When I published a letter in the Independence Examiner in 1963 suggesting that interracial marriages should be judged on the same basis as same race marriages, I was surprised at how strongly some church people reacted. Some thought I had ruined any future ministry that I might possibly have in the church. I recall being shocked during those years when a Gallup poll revealed that Americans who attend church regularly exhibited more racial prejudice than non-church attenders. I suspect the same results will be reached today, pretty confident of it, if we had similar surveys with regard to prejudice toward women and homosexuals. Jimmy Carter recalls coming to the conclusion that government office holders are more likely than church members to reach out to the poor and the oppressed and to seek peace and justice. Because of my civil rights activities and writings, church president W. Wallace Smith, as well as my particular local pastor, regarded me as a communist. Maybe that's why I was a priest for 42 years before I became an elder. They were long dead. That was news to me. I mean, I had voted for Nixon in 1960, but John Kennedy had made me a Democrat. But at least I thought I was a Democrat. But I guess I was wrong, because one day in 1965, I came to work at Herald House and discovered that I was being picketed as a communist on the street in front of our publishing house, the busiest street in Independence. One man spent 13 hours each day, we were open that long for a special open house, spent 13 hours each day for 3 days warning the folks in Independence about my communist leanings. In 1966, I was greatly disappointed when two-thirds of our church's hierarchy, top leaders, whatever you want to call them, general authorities, whatever, Dr. Cheville called them the big boys, all boys then, they refused to sign, two-thirds of them refused to sign the Good Neighbor Pledge, sponsored by the Kansas City Council on Religion and Race, a consortium of Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish religious organizations in the Kansas City area, chaired by Rabbi Bill Silverman. People who signed the pledge would merely promise not to discriminate on the basis of race in the sale of their home. The three churches most prominent in their absence from participation in this council were the Southern Baptists, the RLDS Church, and the LDS Church. I attended the meetings as an unofficial RLDS observer. We had four stakes in the Kansas City area. When a friend, Forrest Swall, and I brought a resolution to our state conference asking the state to support this fair housing effort, it was decisively defeated. One pastor spoke to me afterwards and was so irate that he said he was willing to test me physically. Apparently that would have settled the matter. In April 1967, during my first year, I didn't take him on, in my first year in the faculty at Graceland, Church President W. Wallace Smith, the one that thought I was a communist, published an editorial in the Saints Herald, which deplored sexual immorality, juvenile delinquency, and pornography, and they sort of billed as using kind of major world problems. I was disturbed at how limited and middle class his concerns were. So I wrote a letter in response, published a month later, saying, "But for many people in our world today, there are evils of greater importance." I cited the threat of nuclear war, the population explosion, racial discrimination, the indifference of the affluent nations to starvation within their borders in other parts of the world, the exploitation of the illiterate for the purpose of having what amounts to slave labor, the willingness of the major powers to seek military solutions at the expense of the lives of thousands of innocent persons. It never occurred to me that my letter could harm my employment as a first-year, non-tenured faculty member at the church's only college. And it didn't. And during my 40 years at Graceland, I have never received any pressure from church leaders at any level, nor from from Graceland administrators at any level, over the content of any teachings or writings that I've ever done. Certainly a major influence in my sense of calling to political action came from my professors at St. Paul School of Theology, a Methodist seminary in Kansas City. The Bible came alive for me, especially the teachings of Jesus, and in courses like John Swamley's Christian Social Concerns, we looked at a great variety of social and political issues from the perspective of Jesus. Swamley taught us how to lobby, how to write to our public officials, testify at legislative hearings, and etc. And let me emphasize very strongly here that we Latter-day Saints need to base our understanding of Jesus primarily on the New Testament, especially the four Gospels, and not on the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, or the teachings of general authorities. These are 19th and 20th century testimonies of Jesus. The New Testament writings are first century witnesses to the Christ event. They are the primary witnesses. That's why they're canonized. The Sociology of Religion course made me aware of how much culture affects religion. In church history classes, I read 19th century sermons supporting slavery based on the Bible, and similar 20th century sermons presenting a biblical basis for racial segregation. It became clear to me that it is often not easy for Christians to distinguish between Christ and the culture they are immersed in. This has been a problem in Christianity at least since the Emperor Constantine's conversion in the 4th century. So it is so easy to confuse the norms of our culture with Christianity. As I look back on my own life, and I talked about this last year, I realized that as a result of my family, my church, and the general culture, I was raised racist, sexist, anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic, and homophobic. And there were scriptures to back all of these. And it probably wasn't until late in high school that I developed any sense that these prejudices were contrary to the gospel. I couldn't distinguish between Christ and culture. I was present at that famous meeting in December 2000, January, when candidate George Bush cited Christ as his political philosopher. I'm sure he'd read all the political philosophers, and that's the one that came up. But in the 6.5 years since that debate, it appears to me that the gospel has been losing the contest between Christ and culture for his soul. Jesus came preaching good news to the poor. As if we read the Gospels, it's hard not to conclude that Jesus' biggest concern was for the poor and for those who are on the margins of society. Jim Wallace and his associates at Sojourners counted the passages in the Bible that reflect concern for the poor, and they found several thousand verses. Wallace said that God's politics reminds us of the people who our politics always neglects, the poor, the vulnerable, the left behind. Our government invokes Christ, but rewards its wealthy political supporters with tax cuts and corporate welfare. Today we have checkbook politics, government by the rich for the rich. Both major parties are far too deeply in debt to those who make large campaign contributions. The number of people in poverty has been rising during the Bush administration. This is not just a political issue, it's a moral and religious issue. The central domestic policy of the Bush administration has been tax cuts, which predominantly help the rich. Poverty and our apathy about it is a big part of the problem with regard to racial and ethnic discrimination. Poverty and our apathy about it is a big part of the problem with regard to the treatment of women and children, which is far from what it ought to be. Our churches are largely exempt from government policies that prohibit racial and gender prejudice, but that doesn't exempt us from the judgment of God on these matters. Poverty and our apathy about it is a big part of the problem of abortion. Jimmy Carter wrote reports that 2/3 of women who have had abortions claim their primary reason is that they cannot afford a child. It has been estimated that about 4,000 abortions occur a day in the United States. But about 30,000 children die every day from hunger or poverty-related diseases. Shouldn't pro-life people be concerned about the pro-life issue? This pro-life issue too? Does their pro-life agenda not extend beyond birth? Abortion is an issue that seems to be very polarized, but actually there's a solid majority in the public in the middle, not totally embracing the pro-life position nor accepting abortion on demand. Their position was expressed well by Bill Clinton's frequent statement that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. But in the 2 years that Clinton and the Democrats controlled the government, they did very little to make abortions rare. On the other hand, Republicans have not been willing to recognize that poverty and ignorance have a lot to do with our abortion rate, the highest in the developed nations. Our government has done little to reduce either poverty or ignorance. Why not take seriously the need for a comprehensive K-12 family life education curriculum, if we're for family values, in our schools, which would include a significant sex education component? But sex education is often opposed by conservative Christians, fearing that the more young people know, the more likely they will engage in sexual activity, and thus abstinence education is the only acceptable sex education for them. It seems to me that liberals and conservatives ought to be able to compromise on a program promoting both abstinence and birth control education in order to reduce the number of abortions. If abortion is murder, as some pro-life people say, they should be happy if contraception is reducing unwanted pregnancies. But our government resists making birth control information more available and the means more affordable. It appears that young people in the US, Canada, and Europe are about equally active sexually. But American girls are 5 times as likely to have a baby as French girls, 7 times as likely to have an abortion. And American girls are 70 times as likely to have gonorrhea as the girls in the Netherlands. Ignorance is not bliss. It is morally outrageous that we don't recognize access to health care as a human right, and that more than 40 million Americans, including many children, are without any kind of health coverage. We are alone on this among the so-called developed and civilized nations. My home state of Iowa achieved statehood in 1846. In that decade, the idea of manifest destiny was popular in the United States, the belief that we white Europeans, unlike the Native Americans, knew how to manage this great land that we had now claimed we'd discovered, but actually had stolen. The theory of manifest destiny helped us justify the theft. But since the white man took control of Iowa in the 1840s, half of Iowa's topsoil has washed down the Mississippi River. We are called to be stewards of the Earth's natural resources, but we have raped Mother Earth, and our government shows little concern for the future of our planet. Not long after he was inaugurated, George W. Bush announced that the Kyoto Agreement's mandatory reductions in greenhouse gases would be too expensive and unwise when the United States, richest nation in the world, was facing energy problems. Preserving God's creation for our great-grandchildren is apparently unimportant. Various theologians and philosophers, including Graceland's own Bob Mesley, have said that the first concern of theology should be the welfare of children. Our gun policies are self-destructive. As Jimmy Carter has noted, American children are 16 times more likely than the children in other industrialized countries to be murdered with a gun, and 9 times more likely to die from firearms accidents. Can you imagine Jesus toting a gun? Jesus calls us to love even our enemies and turn the other cheek rather than fighting back. Jesus and the early Christians were pacifists, but most Christians today believe in some type of concept of the just war, classically articulated by St. Augustine in the 5th century. Unfortunately, Christians later engaged in holy wars, unprovoked by the supposed enemy. A simple way to put it is that most Christians think war should be engaged in only as a last resort. But now we have an administration in Washington that believes in preemptive war. Jimmy Carter has written, "The unprecedented adoption of a policy of preemptive war is not only a radical departure from historic policies of the United States, but also a violation of international laws that we have pledged to uphold. Our nation has declared independence from the restraints of international organizations and has disavowed many long-standing global agreements, including judicial decisions, nuclear arms accords, controls on biological weapons, environmental protection, the international system of justice, and the humane treatment of prisoners." Bush's preemptive war doctrine reminds me of the Reverend Carl McIntyre, Presbyterian minister, who in the late 1940s was advocating that we drop the atomic bomb on the Soviet Union before they get their bomb developed. Not all evangelicals are hawks who follow our president's line on the war and other issues. In fact, the National Association of Evangelicals last year issued a statement calling for strict, just war restraints on the initiation of armed conflict with war as only a last resort. 3 evangelical Christians have published books in the past year which I consider to be prophetic voices: Jimmy Carter's Our Endangered Values, Jim Wallace's God's Politics, and Randall Balmer's Thy Kingdom Come. And also, let me mention an earlier book, Tony Campolo's book, Following Jesus Without Embarrassing God. In fact, that's our charge today. Follow Jesus, saints, but please don't embarrass God. Jim Wallace says, almost every major Christian body in the world believes this war of choice in Iraq to be unnecessary and unjust. And the majority of the world's Christians believe the war is wrong, that is better. There's a better way to fight terrorism. Religious leaders in the U.S. have tried to talk to our Christian president, but he won't meet with them. Powerful nations dangerously claim to rid the world of evil, but often do enormous harm in their self-appointed vocation. Jesus, Gandhi, and Martin Luther King have all taught us that violence only increases violence and hatred. I think we've always failed to take into account the wide range of problems that war creates, far beyond the mere accounting of the property damage and the deaths and the physical casualties inflicted. Molly Ivins recently said that George Bush thinks stem cell research is the same as taking human lives, but that 40,000 dead Iraqi civilians is progress toward democracy. In chapter 2 of Ephesians, Paul writes that in Christ, the walls of division between Jew and Gentile are broken down, and we are no longer strangers and aliens. Nationalism is a big barrier to the Christian life, but faith creates community from racial, class, and gender divisions, and prefers international community over nationalist religion. Jesus knows no national boundaries or national preferences. The body of Christ is an international one, and the allegiance of Christians to the gospel must always supersede their national identities. But our current ambassador to the United Nations said, it's a big mistake for us to grant any validity to international law, even when it may seem to be in our short-term self-interest to do so. Because over the long term, the goal of those who think international law really means anything are those who want to constrict the United States. Both the LDS Church and the RLDS and the Community of Christ have the advantage of being international churches rather than churches based solely in the United States. That should help curb the tendency toward nationalism. At our worship services at our world conferences, I especially love the African drums, which you just don't get at Sunday morning worship services in Lamoni, Iowa, or the nearby Mormon ward in Osceola. Most of the biblical prophets, whom we ignore week after week in our congregations, would offer a quite searing indictment of contemporary American society and our government. In the words of that great 8th century prophet Amos, take away from me the noise of your songs, I will not listen to the melody of your harps, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. History is most changed by social movements with a spiritual foundation. Most of the important movements for social change in America have been fueled by religion, progressive religion. The civil rights movement succeeded because it first built a movement that was morally based and politically independent. I would say that early in my independence experience in the 1960s, I felt not only a calling to Christian political action, but also a sense that all committed Christians should be sensitive to the conflict between Christ and culture and try our best to understand where these conflicts exist and do our best to work for justice whenever we can. This inevitably draws you into politics in one form or another. Jim Wallace has said that many Democrats have wanted to restrict religion to the private sphere, and that's no doubt true. On the other hand, the Republicans have had an alliance with the religious right for more than 25 years. This alliance has been very good for the Republican Party, but not for Christianity. Professor Randall Balmer of Barnard College, who spoke at the MHA in Kirtland, has a new book, Thy Kingdom Come, How the Religious Right Distorts the Faith and Threatens America, and Evangelicals Lament. Evangelical Protestantism rose in the 18th century as a protest against the elites who, to a great extent, controlled religious thought in America. Evangelicals were marginalized people, but they were able to challenge the slavery system from the perspective of Jesus and the Hebrew prophets and Moses. In the 19th century, they continued to challenge the slave system and were also involved in various reforms, such as the temperance movement and the women's rights movement. In the 20th century, much of the leadership of the civil rights movement came from clergy, most especially black evangelical Protestant ministers. but in the late 1970s and 1980s, some evangelical Protestant leaders sought an alliance with the Republican Party, and the new Christian right was born. Bomer has shown that the religious right began not over abortion, as is commonly believed, but as a reaction to the IRS denial of a tax-exempt status to Bob Jones University because of their racist policies. Later, abortion became a central issue, and more recently, anti-gay rights has become a central issue for them. Unfortunately, its agenda has been a marked departure from the evangelical past. Instead of supporting the oppressed and marginalized in society, the religious right has embraced the rich and the powerful. According to Bomer, the leaders of the religious right have led their sheep astray from the gospel of Jesus Christ to the false gospel of neoconservative ideology. The social and economic policies of this political alliance is creating a permanent underclass, so much for Jesus' concern for the poor. Despite the evidence from history that religion suffers when it is enforced by the state, the religious right has sought to restore prayer in public schools and place Ten Commandment plaques and statutes in the halls of government. They seek to replace science with theology in the public school curriculum. The religious right seeks to encode its version of morality into civil and criminal law, but Bomer asserts that religion in America has always functioned best from the margins, outside the political order, outside the circles of power, and that any grasping for religious hegemony ultimately trivializes and diminishes the faith. Evangelicals need once again to learn to be a counterculture, much as they were before the rise of the religious right, before succumbing to the seductions of power. A counterculture can provide a critique of the powerful because it is utterly disinterested. It has no investment in the power structure itself. The coalition with the Republican Party is blasphemy, pure and simple, says Bomer. Corporate interests are treated with a kind of reverence and deference once reserved for the deity. At the March on Washington in August 1963, there were 10 great speeches. I watched them all on television, and not just King's dream speech. I recall the one where Rabbi Joachim Prinz made comparisons to the Nazi Holocaust, suggesting that to be neutral is to be on the side of injustice. In Germany, those who stood by and did nothing share the blame for the Holocaust. It's often tempting to want to stay out of it, to remain neutral. But clearly, silence is not neutral. If we are silent, we are supporting the injustices of the powers that be. I think Christians have a moral obligation not only to vote, but to be actively engaged in politics, not for self-interest, as most people do, but for the public good, as Jesus would say we should. There are many things a person can do. You'll be well-informed and try to persuade friends. Be active and actively involved in campaigns or parties where you believe they are more consistent with Christian principles. Write letters to periodicals, lobby your public officials, testify at legislative hearings, or run for public office yourself if the situation seems right. Sometimes litigation is the answer. Years ago, my eighth grade daughter wanted the state of Iowa to allow junior and senior high girls to play the real game of basketball, not just the half court, three on three, no two dribble rules that were enforced for many decades in Iowa. There was no hope of change by the legislature, by the Department of Education, or the Girls Athletic Association. So Shauna joined an interest group and became the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit that eventually led to the change. And sometimes protests and demonstrations are the only solution. In the first half of the 20th century, in the southern states, the governors, the legislators, the administrative agencies, and even the courts were not open to challenging the segregation laws, even though they were clearly unconstitutional. Any Southern judge worth his salt knew that. I was proud of Graceland students 3 years ago when they picketed the Baptist church in our town of Lamoni during their Wednesday night service because their speaker was a nationally known so-called scientist whose research was so blatantly biased against homosexuals, leading to outrageous conclusions which any reasonable person knew were not true. About 75 students at our small college and more than a dozen faculty and staff participated in this protest, which drew live television coverage on the CBS affiliate in Des Moines and an article in the Des Moines Register. Christians cannot afford to be apathetic about politics. The stakes are too high. As my sister Rita once put it, politics can be exciting like a football game, but a lot more rides on the outcome. during Grant McMurray's presidency of the Community of Christ, he challenged us to be a prophetic people rather than just a people with a prophet. I believe that all Christians are charged with the prophetic responsibility of challenging the powers that be when injustice occurs. That takes you into the political arena. There's no avoiding it. So let me close with my other favorite passage from the Old Testament, from the Hebrew prophets, Micah 6. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? Thank you.
Strong words. N.T. Wright, in his book Jesus and the People of God, outlines a rigid purity system of first century Judea and Galilee. The Jewish purity system, based on laws and commentary, both written and verbal, identified who was in and who was out, who was right, who was wrong, who was pure according to the law and who was impure, who were revered as powerful authority figures and who were dismissed as powerless and invisible. The wealthy, the Pharisees, the scribes were able to keep the law because they had slaves or servants to do the menial, dirty tasks that rendered a person ritually unclean. Carpenters and tradesmen were in the middle of the purity scale. Farmers, the people of the land, and shepherds were on the bottom of the rung, because they could not always wash their hands before breaking bread. They were constantly in contact with sick or dying animals, birthing lambs, bloody wounds, dead carcasses, all of which rendered them unclean. Clear off the scale and not even to be considered were the lame, the blind, the lepers, the Samaritans and Gentiles, the women and children. Women belonged to their fathers until they were married, after which they belonged to their husbands. And heaven help the woman who lost her husband and became a widow, because then she was the property of no one and was cast off, with no one to protect her, no one to help her, belonging to none. They were the poorest of the poor. Jesus of Nazareth turned the first century purity system on its head. He touched lepers, and women. He talked to Samaritans. He healed the blind and the lame. He raised the marginalized and impoverished, telling them of such was the kingdom of God. He was never politically correct, but he challenged the power structures at every turn. To paraphrase a quote that Bill used in his paper, Jesus spoke and acted out truth to power. And they killed him for it. Being a disciple, a follower of Jesus, means that we are called to act as Jesus did. We are called to Christian political action, to stand over and against the purity system of our day. We are called to be truly countercultural in representing the kingdom of God, what we call Zion. Bill has taken us on a journey of remembrance. Through his eyes, we catch a glimpse of the men and women, small and great, who have influenced him in his role of advocate for the ethical, the poor, the racially marginalized, the ecologically sustainable, and the peaceable people. He offers a brief critique of American society and the current political scene, and touches on the problems of war, gender, discrimination, and poverty. He gives us a critique of the nation and nationalism, of the U.S. government, both parties, of the current administration, of the NRA, and the religious right. But mostly, he gives us a critique of silence. In a summary much too brief and sweeping, we hear of Bill's involvement in political activism and civil disobedience during key moments in the civil rights movement of our country, and his willingness to stand, as Jesus did, against the purity system of our day. Along the way, the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Community of Christ, as it's now called, also comes in for its share of critique. We have, at times, been very guilty of narrow vision, the failure to truly be a prophetic people. And we live in the midst of a culture that is slow to change and uphold the worth of persons, a tenet which for us is one of the hallmarks of our faith. We are called to be a prophetic people. We are supposed to be a peace church, dedicated to peace and justice, reconciliation, the healing of the spirit. Through Bill's remarks, you can see clearly how we have failed in that challenge. His purpose, however, was not to point out just the failures or to capture us with a swashbuckling tale of conflict with civil authorities or to flaunt our pride and prejudice, but rather his purpose comes clear in the multitude of suggestions that he offers for making a difference, for becoming involved, for taking a step forward as activists in the political and social arena. Simply outlining the problem is not enough. It must be handled, addressed, It must be handled, addressed, without losing hope. By offering practical and doable suggestions that can be implemented on a variety of levels, Bill holds out the possibility that each person can make a difference. One step at a time, one call or letter at a time, followers of Jesus can impact both the political arena and the world. For those who heard the message and will commit to following through, Bill himself has the opportunity once again to make a difference by answering the call to Christian political action and calling us to do the same. He reminds us that we are to follow Jesus without embarrassing God.
Well, that was a whole lot nicer than those letters I used to get from apostles and presidents in the past. So we've got 20 minutes, 19 or 20 minutes. So since we don't have the chairperson didn't show up, be sure and have some questions of Susan as well, or make comments as you want. So yes, in the back. I'm sorry. And we'd like to get this on the. Oh, I see. Here's the mic. Okay. So anybody else who would like to follow as our second and third speaker, after Charlene, come on down and stand behind her. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I would recommend careful study of the scriptures, but especially the New Testament and especially the Gospels. Study of theologians and biblical scholars who have helped us understand better the teachings of Jesus. Since I'm saying that's our norm, and so try to better understand what the teachings of Jesus and the theology that arises naturally from it. There are a lot of authors today, biblical scholars and theologians, who give us very good advice. And I think that serves as a useful criticism to our own tendency just to see it from our own eyes. So hopefully that's helpful. Yes?
I'd like to make some comments and then ask you both a question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that too often Democrats get in a defensive position. They say, well, we have to defend abortion and gay rights and mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think there's a lot of issues people should bring up, but mm-hmm. how the Republicans and Mormons have departed and how that issue needs to be focused on.
Yeah.
10 years ago, the genealogy building was shot. Chris and Hinckley said maybe we need some kind of gun restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
And the Utah legislature gave him a pat on the back like he was a little kid looking for a cookie. Like
oh, yeah.
Third grade class.
Yeah.
Did nothing, so there was no use for a special session, dismissed him on his way.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You look at Senator Hatch, biggest contributor to tobacco money, take as much tobacco money as Jesse Helms has.
Uh-huh.
How does that represent?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How does your filibuster get tougher tobacco laws? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Drunk driving, same thing. They take the alcohol money, they vote to win the laws.
Yeah.
Bob Jones University, you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Reid had to get a tough, violent, the Senate floor to condemn them because their website condemned Catholics and Mormons and religious cults.
Yeah.
Counterfeit Christian cults.
Yeah.
On the website.
That's right.
I don't know why this isn't brought up. But the question seems to be, well, 91% of the people in Provo voted Republican, voted for Bush. And they say he's a good, God-fearing Christian man. He's going to lead the fight on terrorism, much like Russia's Putin is, which I think is another idiot.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But is it bad in your church where 91%, now not all Mormons, I think nationwide we're 70%, let's say in Ohio and California, it's much less than Utah. But 91% of any county in the community of Christ vote for Bush or vote for Republican.
No. No. I think the community of Christ probably has a fairly normal cross-section of society in terms of Republicans and Democrats. I do also know that, well, I'm pretty sure I know this, that among our top leaders, there's more Democrats than Republicans. I think quite a few more. But at any rate, we do have a pretty good cross-section in our rank and file. At Graceland, where I teach, I think the faculty have been 60-40 Democratic. Yeah, in Iowa, yeah, yeah. And Iowa's a pretty swing state. But Graceland's faculty, I don't know about student body, would be a little more Democratic than the state of Iowa. So, but again, you know, like I said, I criticize both parties. I obviously criticize Republicans a whole lot more because they've got a lot more, you know, to criticize. But it's, our church has a pretty good variety. We, Standing High Council, spoke out against the first Gulf War. Now, I don't think they've made a statement on the second, on the current war. Standing High Council took a position against capital punishment by 1995. That was used by Senator Leonard Boswell, a Community of Christ person who is probably the strongest person in the Iowa legislature as president of the Senate, in a legislature that was divided one house each way, and a governor of the Republican Party. Leonard used our church's position to justify leading the charge, or helping lead the charge against the death penalty in Iowa when we refused to restore the death penalty. So anyway, yeah, we've had a significant amount of activism in the church, which I think, you know, is more consistent with the teachings of Jesus. Again, Jim Wallace is right. God is neither Republican or Democrat. You know, we're best operating from the margins of society, not trying to at least get our church leaders in the center of power. You know, Hatch and the others you mentioned, probably a little too corrupted. I saw Hatch 3 times when he was running for president, and the first one I went to, the first question was about gun control, and he came across as the strongest advocate of your right to own guns as anybody I've ever heard. And I thought, and at that and several other Republican things I went to, gosh, going to Republican presidential campaign events is a whole different world than the Democratic events I went to. Glenn.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe Susan wanted to respond.
No.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Do you agree with my analysis?
Yeah. As usual, I agree with Glenn's analysis. But I think on poverty, the problem is that only a relatively small segment of society are poor. And so even the Democrats, who've done a better job reflecting the poor's interests, still have a bigger loyalty to the middle class and the larger donors, which really tones down that interest an awful lot. I think, though, that the in terms of the focus on abortion and then anti-gay rights, I think abortion, in fact, Randall Balmer, you know, evangelical historian, and he's gone to a lot of these meetings. He was at a meeting where top leaders like Paul Weyrich admitted, yeah, IRS racism at Bob Jones really is what started the religious right, and then later we embraced abortion. It seems to me like abortion, again, I think you need to see it from the perspective of the Republican Party. They've embraced the religious right, and abortion is a very, you know, to talk about the right to life in a very, you know, very sacred terms, you know, can be very appealing. And then, you know, homosexuality, there's an issue which an awful lot of American people carry an awful lot of prejudice, so I think it's just a clear, you know, appeal to their prejudice, and so that's been an additional thing. The Republican Party has been able to work with the religious right, embrace that program, and you know, it won the election for Bush because there's 11 states that had an anti-gay marriage amendment on the statute, including Ohio, and that energized the religious right. A good friend of mine, Senator from Iowa, Dick Clark, was defeated for re-election in 1978 when it looked like a shoe-in. He'd always had high ratings, but the religious right, I think, is their first big success in U.S. Senate races. And then in 1980, they won a bunch, knocked off a lot of senators, and really went on. So I probably talked too long, and be sure and jump in. Maybe sit over here, and you can get up and use the mic.
I can
easier. Sure. We'll just kind of stand side by side here and just don't drink my Coke here.
I think one of the things we have to recognize, too, is that the media comes into this. A number of decades ago, poverty and civil rights and women's issues were very much in the news, and it raised the consciousness of people, and we made certain steps along the way to improve in those areas. But as you improve in those areas, the media drops the topic. And so you raise the awareness only so far, and then you kind of plateau. And if you are... If you've been paying attention, there are still very serious civil rights issues that are occurring in our nation with Hispanic people as well as the blacks, immigration and non-immigration issues. There are still women's issues and gender issues that need to be addressed. Poverty continues to be a concern. Maybe some of you are aware of the Sojourners' recent protest in Washington, D.C., and one of the staff members who serves under me wrote and asked if his job would be in jeopardy if he could participate in that civil disobedience act in Washington, D.C., protesting a budget that was very much in favor of the rich and cutting out the support for the poor. Our church actually has a policy statement about how to be involved in civil disobedience. And so I implemented that policy, shared that with this young man, Brad Shoemate was his name, who went out to Washington, D.C. and, you know, knelt there in the government building, was arrested with the others for praying on government property, and, was hauled off to jail and paid his fine. But he had some people who were definitely against him. He was hurt in the process, not a major hurt, but his handcuffs were much too tight. He was put into a place that was much too cold, and it actually affected him physically doing that. But he stood up for what he believed. And our church believes that it's very important that people have that right to be involved in civil disobedience. So I just need to mention that those are some of the ways to continue to raise the issues, is to be involved in civil disobedience. I'm telling you, yes, be subversive. And since I represent, for me, in my church, I represent the institution of the church, too, it means sometimes you have to be subversive against the institution of the church, against me, if what you are standing for is right.
Good. Just sit down the close chair, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. Other comments, questions?
I have one,
Bill. Yeah, oh, I'm sorry, Kent. You're not the man with the mic. You're there for to talk. Ken Olson.
I'm almost sure that I know what your response would be, but I would to this mm-hmm. question, but I would like to know what Elder Score, is that the way you're addressed in the community of Christ?
Susan.
We used to have a presidency of Wally and Bud and Al, but anyway, go ahead.
When I have seen issues brought up into that bill would be cowards.
I'd say take the risk, yeah. Anyway.
But I would just mm-hmm. how this situation is handled in the community of mm-hmm. Christ congregation.
Yeah. I think you probably get. Do you want to speak first? I think you probably rightly guessed what I would have said, if you want.
Our church is a church of great diversity. And so we have political stances all the way from gun-toting, radical, conservative, politically conservative people, to those who would be at the far extreme of liberal openness and left-wing civil disobedience. Yeah. So, and our congregations reflect the same kind of diversity as does our World Conference. So what happens in our church when an issue comes up that is politically tinged, if it is not coming up at World Conference, if it's coming up in other ways, then our leadership and our members are all free to speak their minds and to take action as individuals, but not as representatives of the church. We do have to still be very careful that we do not take political action under the guise that it represents the entire church. So that is one of the limitations that we place on ourselves. because we do have such a diverse number of voices within the church. That limits what we can do. But surprisingly enough, even with that limitation, our leadership, our presidents, prophet presidents, have still been able at times to be very active, involved publicly and by name in issues of poverty, which most people can agree on. Many issues of civil liberties, which people can agree on regardless of their political stance. Now, in World Conference, we have another issue, and that is that we are a global community. And so there are a number of things that come up regarding United States liberties and issues that do not impact other nations in exactly the same way, or are illegal to even consider in many of our other nations. We have issues that come up on our World Church Conference floor that if we were to deal with them, it would require a number of our delegations to simply get up and leave and be out of the conference chamber while we deal with those, because they could be arrested when they go home for even being part of the discussion or being privy to the discussion, even if they did not voice their opinions. So we have to be conscious of that on the World Conference floor, and as a result, there are a number of United States issues that we cannot address in our World Conference. What I hope will be happening in the future is that we will establish a United States jurisdictional church, just as we now have a Canadian church and an African church, with abilities by the First Presidency, authorized by the First Presidency, to deal with legal and legislative issues for those jurisdictions that don't impact the United States. And I'm hoping that we will set up that kind of a arena for the United States Church, where we can deal with some of the issues that are specific and pertinent to the United States but maybe cannot be dealt with yet in other nations that do not have those freedoms and those privileges. And if that can happen, we will have a major step forward in terms of being able to have a more united voice on issues of political action that you mentioned and we're talking about.
Okay, any other questions, comments? We've got about 3 minutes to go, and I want to run us over time since it'd be tempting for the chair to let the thing go over time. Come on up here, Christian. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you. So Christian will be next, and then, yeah.
I had a question that sort of dovetails with that, which is in America we have this ethos of a separation of church and state, which seems to be, in this meeting at least, clearly violated. Mm-hmm. And that for a lot of converts to our church, mm-hmm. that's actually comforting, that you can hold whatever political beliefs you want and still feel like you're a member of the church and don't need to defend yourself about on political front, whether or not that actually is true, that mm-hmm. there's at least that sort of patina there. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the challenges converts to your religion face as having a very liberal and accepting worldview who might be coming from extremely restrictive ones? I served my mission in rural Texas, so mm-hmm. I got to see quite a bit of this.
Well, certainly, we've had a lot of growth in Africa and Haiti, and for example, on the issue of homosexuality, that when Grant McMurray made a very accepting, lengthy statement during his World Conference sermon in 2002, a lot of the flack that came back came from the American South and from Africa. I'm not sure about Haiti. That's why Susan's comment about having national churches would be helpful, because you know, in some of these countries you couldn't even mention the issue and might get in real trouble if you did or were involved in any way. In America, we have separation of church and state under the First Amendment. The government shall not establish religion. That means all kinds of things. But we also have the free exercise of religion. Obviously, as Susan is saying, President Steve Easy or Gordon B. Hinckley or Apostle Score or others in an official capacity can't be making political judgment and endorsing political candidates. But again, if we're to be a prophetic people, then all of us should be involved in pursuing those just issues we think that our Christian calling calls us to, and sometimes we'll disagree. You know, there's plenty of disagreements. There's some people from a moral perspective are anti-abortion. Other people from a moral perspective are pro-life. It's a conflicting moral position. Same thing would be true of homosexuality and all kinds of other things. So there might, and capital punishment, I sponsored the motion, the World Conference in 2000 that embraced capital punishment. I was careful to make my speech in a global setting instead of American setting. But anyway, yeah, I think those difficulties aren't hard to manage if we understand the Constitution. And always, maybe the most important thing, and I'll close on this because our time's up, it's always important to be loving and respectful to those we disagree with. That's, I think, the fundamental principle above all else. And if you're, and in those cases when I've been respectful of those who, in fact, the guy who wanted to fight me, we became good friends. You know, we had a meeting a couple days later when he cooled down a bit, and things worked out just fine. So anyway, thanks very much for coming.